Good afternoon, may it please the court. I'm John Rebellious with the Public Defender's Office, and I represent Wayne Fonke. My bar registration number is 41168. Your Honors, this afternoon I plan to address the second issue in the opening brief, which is the extortion elemental instruction issue. If this court has questions on the other issues, I will try to address those. Your Honors, it's a fundamental principle of constitutional law that appellate courts do not get to resolve factual questions meant for the jury. The parties here agree that a conviction for extortion in this case required the jury to find the following three facts beyond a reasonable doubt. One, that Mr. Fonke substantially threatened the alleged victims. Two, that he threatened them with financial hardship. And three, that he made this threat by performing an illegal act. The parties here agree that Mr. Fonke did not receive jury findings on these facts because the jury was not instructed to find these facts. And finally, Your Honors, the parties here agree that the instructions that the jurors received in this case were a pattern on a statute that was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court and then repealed by our state legislature. And the state, moreover, does not dispute that the instruction here, the language in the instruction here, deviated substantially from the language in the statute. Now, under these uncontested facts and principles, Your Honor, reversal is required regardless of whether or not this is a trial error or a structural error. Now, the state erroneously argues that this court can affirm because the omitted elements are not adequately contested below. But this argument is erroneous both as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. First, under our Supreme Court decision in Weinreich, whether or not the defendant adequately contests the elements is irrelevant. The language in the instructions here materially deviated from the language of the statute, and the instructions here were patterned on theory of liability, that was repealed by our state legislature. And additionally, a correct instruction on the crime of extortion was readily available to the trial court in the 2008 Colgee supplement. Under Weinreich, there's no further inquiry necessary by this court. The prejudice is that the jury was instructed on a theory of liability that doesn't exist.
Mr. Gregilius, what is your response to Mr. First's contention that, if I recall correctly, that on two of the three differences between the jury instructions and the new statute, that the issues were not contested at the trial?
Well, I disagree with that statement, Your Honor. The defense at trial did contest that the alleged victims were threatened in any manner. So it certainly follows as a matter of logic that we contested that they were substantially threatened, because a substantial threat requires a higher burden on the prosecutor's part to prove. And similarly, the degree of harm was an open question below. Under Kaufman, we don't necessarily look at the defendant's closing argument to determine what's contested. We look at what facts were presented to the jury. And here, the jury certainly had some question as to the degree of harm that was threatened to the alleged victims in this case, because they found under the computer crime statute that the degree of harm suffered by the alleged victims in this case was worth less than $500. Now, whether or not a harm of less than $500 constitutes a significant injury to a company making between $23,000 and $40,000 a month certainly is an issue that this court cannot resolve in the state's favor on appeal. As I alluded to, Your Honors, the problem with the instructions, aside from the fact that their pattern on the theory of liability doesn't exist, is that they did lower the prosecutor's burden. And under Kaufman, reversals also required. So, Your Honors, it doesn't really matter whether or not this court really looks under Weinreich or under Kaufman and Ahman, because the result is the same. If this court does not vacate my client's extortion conviction, then it should reverse, because this court cannot speculate as to what a correctly instructed jury would have found.
Mr. Gregilius, you just mentioned vacating as one alternative and reversing as another. Mm-hmm. And I know you set forth like several, at least three different theories for either reversal or vacating or setting aside the verdict. Which of your theories leads to reversal and a new trial, and which would just lead to either elimination of the verdict and no further proceedings?
Your Honor, as I've argued before this court on issue two, just as an instructional error, the remedy under Weinreich and under Kaufman and Ahman would be reversal. However, I do argue in the briefs, and I'm certainly not conceding them, but arguing just this issue today, that it was a constitutionally void conviction under Wimbush. And I did challenge the sufficiency of the evidence under the extortion count as well. And both of those theories would require that this court vacate my client's conviction instead of reverse as to extortion.
Okay, thank you.
If there are no further questions on this issue, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Well, I'd like to ask, and you may not be prepared to address the sufficiency. Could you address that briefly?
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple of different approaches. I think the one way of looking at it is that my client, he didn't make a threat. He took the action that he thought he could do, and then he asked for payment in return. And under my reading of the statute, that is not a threat within our understanding of the word threat. And it's certainly not a substantial threat.
So what does substantial threat mean?
Well, if you read the statutory language, it means a threat that is reasonably likely to induce a belief that the threat will be carried out and is one that threatens significant confinement, restraint, injury, or damage will occur. And the second aspect to my sufficiency argument is that I don't believe that the prosecution submitted sufficient evidence to show that we threatened a significant financial hardship upon this company.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, please, the court, John First for the people. The only real question here today is whether there's whether the defendant can show a reasonable possibility that the erroneous instruction contributed to the conviction. In other words, it's a plain error case. And by definition, plain error is a case-by-case determination. And Wainwright doesn't say otherwise. I mean, it's just, Wainwright was a plain error case. I mean, the holding there was that the instruction did not substantially conform to the existing statute. It was plain error, and that's what the court said, because there was a reasonable possibility the jury convicted the defendant for behavior that was not causally connected to the daughter's death, as contemplated by the information statute. I mean, Wainwright, it's not a structural error case. I mean, if all you have to show is that an instruction substantially deviated from the statute, you get structural error. But we have to look at this. And that's why this, you know, cases like Wainwright are not very helpful, really, in determining what was the error here, is trial error here. Did the trial error resulting from the instruction contribute to the defendant's conviction?
Mr. First, if I could back you up a little bit to ask you a question about structural error. I know you said in your brief that this wasn't structural error based upon court cases that have said, like Netter versus the United States and Griego, that have said that if there's an error or an omission in the instructions, then we review for plain error.
Correct.
As far as I can recall, those cases dealt with like one error or omission. Mr. Gravilia said, well, this case involves three errors or omissions, and therefore it changes the calculus and transforms the standard of review to structural error.
Well, that's not what Johnson says, which is a plain error case on instruction. There was an omitted element. The judge took away the element of materiality and perjury. Perjury charge took it away from the jury, so it's pretty clear that it's substantially conformed to the statute. Griego took away the element of knowledge. The jury wasn't instructed on knowingly. That certainly didn't substantially conform to the statute. Going back to Johnson, it says versus United States, the seriousness of the error does not remove the consideration from Crim P 52B. I mean, that's plain error. Yeah, sure, this is serious, but we still have to, you know, three mistakes, yes, but if you look at each one, you have to look at each one individually. Did each one contribute to the conviction? So let's...
Mr. First?
Yes.
Can I ask you to address the PD's contention that because they, the theory of defense was no threat occurred, as I understand your brief, you argue the substantiality of the threat was uncontested at trial. I don't understand logically how those two work together.
Well, you can certainly say that there was no threat. If there was no threat, that argument would be the same under either version of the statute. If you say there was no threat occurred at all, then there was no threat under the old version, and there was no substantial threat under the other. But it's the degree of the threat that the legislature changed, pursuant, you know, in part to Wimbush, and in part to the dissent in Wimbush. So they added this element of substantial threat, and they went on, the legislature went on to define it. And so that's what, and to say there would be, you know, as I recall in the reply brief, it would have been superfluous to argue substantial threat. Well, that's true if he had known about if the defense had cared about it. I mean, they didn't care enough to get the right version of it. I'm not casting blame. Everybody, prosecution submitted the instruction. Defense could have got the right instruction. Court should have. Nobody did. So it didn't seem to matter. It wouldn't have, the argument, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the argument would not have changed, it appears, given, based on what version of the statute they were arguing. Bottom line for the defense was there was no threat, period.
And that doesn't that itself make it contested?
Not the degree of the threat. No, the element is a substantial threat, not whether there be threat at all. And even if it was contested, Your Honor, for argument's sake, the evidence is overwhelming that there was a substantial threat. Again, going to the definition, reasonably likely to induce a belief that the threat will be carried out and threatens significant injury or damage will occur. Well, the threat here was the refusal, was the requirement of demand of payment, $2,000. Well, that went back and forth from 900, anyway, from 900, he told police later that initially $2,000, unless, for him to restore the website. That's the threat, because he shut it down, and he held it hostage until, unless the victims paid him the $2,000 to turn it back on, to restore it. $2,000 on income of $23,000 to $26,000 a month seems substantial. Seems like a significant injury. I mean, it's not, if the injury were, if the website were down for 10 minutes and they missed a couple of clicks for somebody wanting their hair done or something, maybe that's not significant, but that's not what we have.
Mr. First, maybe you could point me in the record, and maybe I misread the record, but the victim's testimony appeared inconsistent as to how long the website was down. It appeared to me to be unclear how long that website was down at all, and thus what the actual injury was.
Well, there is testimony that testimony from the husband. It said the web page that was up at the time of trial was not always the page that was up. Web page changed mid-January. He shut it down, I think, around February 23rd or so. Went back to the original form 2 days before trial.
I understand that, but the wife's testimony is not, it conflicts a bit with the husband's testimony.
Just looking at notes that I have from the...
And that's fine, we can double check, but
yes,
and there seems to be some conflict in evidence about the economic injury.
Well, it's, if that's the case, then I didn't see that, Your Honor. If that's the case, okay. Then I would say that would affect the overwhelming aspect of the evidence if there, there's a conflict.
Well, how so?
Well, I would, it would be, how far you may guess myself.
Well, that sounds like someone to play that out there.
Should I stand up?
I mean, is that not right, though? I mean, that this seems to work directly against your argument.
Well, it does. That's what I'm saying. I mean, if there's a conflict in the evidence, it would be less overwhelming than if some aspect of the evidence was undisputed.
Or not overwhelming, maybe.
That's what I'm saying.
Less overwhelming. Not.
I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstand your question before I dig my hole any deeper.
Well, just, I mean, it's your position, this is, let's assume it's analyzed under plain error. Okay, I'll go that far. All right, is this obvious?
Sure. They changed the statute in 1994. Yeah, it's
okay.
Obvious.
So we've got an obvious. Now, we've got a jury that was not instructed on the question of a degree, a substantial threat. But how do we step in and say, well, not plain error?
By finding overwhelming evidence that the threat was substantial, that it met the definition in 18.3.207, subparagraph 3, that it met that definition. If the court finds that, then the error is not plain. The same with economic hardship versus injury. Obviously, there's a difference. Injury, again, would be going back to the one surfer, one web surfer clicks, one click, and it's one click, that's probably an injury, but is it a hardship? Probably not. If the website's down from February 23rd till a couple days before trial, that's significant.
Mr. First, you were saying a few minutes ago that $2,000 worth of damages might be a significant injury or a significant amount of damages. Is that what you said, or am I confused?
Yes, go ahead.
But if the evidence is that the company was earning $23,000 a month, and how can we determine as an appellate court whether that was constituted economic hardship, especially if the jury was only instructed in terms of economic injury?
Well, again, it seems to us that it's overwhelming. And going back to $2,000 is, I may be confusing myself as well as the court. $2,000 was the threat. It was the demand to get the website turned back on. The economic injury was, husband testified 60 to 70% of their business is online. So if 60 to 70% of, and then their business is $23,000 to $26,000 a month, that's more than half of that business they're losing as long as the website is shut down. That was the testimony. That was undisputed.
Was there any testimony about what the business owners might have done if they, didn't pay the $2,000 to get someone else to start up their website? Because I would think that would have had an impact on, how long their business would not be known on the internet.
Well, that's true. I don't think there was any.
Okay.
I don't believe anything like that.
Okay.
But that's just not evidence before the court. It could have been, but certainly in one way or another.
Right. Okay.
And briefly, turning to the unlawful act, and that's the element that we're most concerned about, because the jury just didn't get that one. That wasn't presented. That wasn't one of the elements presented. So then the question is whether there's legal justification for the defendant to essentially hold the website hostage. And I think the salient point there is that before the defendant started working on the website, it was a fully functioning website. Victims own the website, they always own that website, they own the domain name. Regardless, and the dispute, this legitimate dispute, which was based there, which was their defense at trial, was there was a legitimate dispute, in other words, it was civil, notwithstanding that dispute over who made the changes and who was entitled to the changes made by the defendant, the defendant took it offline, refused to give them back the original website in its original form, unquestionably owned by the victims. And the fact that it was able to be restored 2 days before trial shows that the defendant had the capability to restore it in its original form and then fight about it. So that's a reasonable possibility that a jury would have, could not have found that was illegal, no. Unless the court had any other questions, we ask you for thanks.
Thank you, Mr. First. Mr. Gravelli, you have about 8.5 minutes remaining.
Your Honor, I just got a couple points with respect to the record and in reference to some of your questions for the state. Judge Talman, you had asked if there's any indication in the record as to what the business owners might have done to sort of cover. And there actually is testimony from Murat, I believe is how you pronounce her name, and this is on December 13th, 2011. On pages 191 and 192, is they said that they had purchased another website at hairdressers.com. As to what that website consisted of and how developed it was, we don't know. That issue was never really addressed at trial, and that fact, those facts weren't really flushed out. But there's some indication that they did own another website wholly separate from the one at issue here. Judge Dunn, going back to your exchange with the state, we don't know how long the website was shut down. And actually, Craig Bretman testified as much. He said he does not know how long the website was down, and that's on page 240, occurring on December 13th transcript. He did testify that the original website went up 2 days ago, but what he means by original, and it's a little unclear, but I think he means the one that he created along with his wife, and not necessarily the one that the defendant modified. We do not know how long the website was down. It certainly was an open question below as to whether or not this was a significant financial hardship. We don't even know exactly how much money was demanded. There's a conflict in testimony as to whether it was $914 or $2,000 or $2,000 or more. And Your Honors, this is a case of plain error if I've ever seen one. This court should not find facts that the jury needed to resolve. And my client asks for nothing less than what the Constitution allows him, and that's a jury to determine whether or not he's guilty of the crime of extortion. I therefore ask that this court vacate his extortion conviction and reverse on the remaining. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gravelli. Thanks again, Mr. First. We appreciate both of your fine arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue. The oral argument in our next.